Cuban Demonstrations and the Role of the Diaspora. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It started more than a week ago. Protests exploded in Cuba as residents reached a boiling point over lack of food, power, and vaccines. The response has spread to Miami, throughout South Florida, and even to Washington, D.C.
I don't think that that change has a clear definition.
Today on Sundial, we're going to look at the current situation in Cuba and how the diaspora is trying to push for change on the communist island. We have a panel of Cuban-American voices from the media, art, and academia. And we want to hear from you. Join today's conversation on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. You can also email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us today. Well, over the past week, Cuba has experienced some of the largest political demonstrations since the Cuban Revolution. In response, President Biden announced yesterday plans to look at remittances and the U.S. Embassy in Havana. Now, since the start of this uprising in Cuba, there have been questions about the role the U.S. government should play. Today on Sundial, we're going to spend the entire hour looking at the story of Cuba from a few different perspectives. We're going to get an update on the demonstrations happening on the island and here in the U.S. We're going to hear from artists about the role they're playing to inspire change. And we're going to learn more about the efforts to get aid to Cubans abroad. Joining me now in the studio, WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. Also joining us via Zoom, the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald reporter Nora Gámez-Torres. And Orlando Gutierrez Boronat, who leads the Cuban Democratic Directorate and the Assembly of the Cuban Resistance. And I appreciate all my guests joining me. Also, by the way, this conversation is open to everyone. Find us on social media at WLRN Sundial. You could post your comment or question there about maybe what you're hearing from family or friends back in Cuba. You can also send us a text, 786-677-0767. Again, that's 786-677-0767. And I'm leaving this open to a lot of different possibilities here. Again, maybe you have friends or family back home in Cuba. You could tell us about what you're hearing. If communication is open, maybe perhaps you want to share your thoughts on what the role of the U.S. government should be in this issue. Orlando, I want to start with you. Kind of go back and help us understand, what are all the factors that led to these demonstrations? Again, the biggest we've seen in over 50 years. What started all of this?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on. There's been deep discontent among the Cuban people for all these 62 years. In the past, the regime has been able to isolate and crush uprisings against the regime. But there's always been some kind of dissident or resistance activity against this regime. I think that the final straw that has sparked these protests are, number one, Cubans deem Díaz-Canel as a deeply illegitimate ruler. Cubans are tired of living under a one-party state where economic life is controlled to the most minimal. There are widespread shortages. There have been throughout the life of this regime, but especially now because of the pressure and the restrictions placed by the regime on independent farmers. And that started about 2 years ago. Also, and I think most importantly, sanctions have been effective in affecting the finances and the structure of the military repressive apparatus. And there's been a very active resistance movement in Cuba made up of dissidents throughout the country who work every day to educate about democracy and freedom. I think the presence of social media and the access to social media for many youth has been important. And I think there's, as we heard in these demonstrations throughout Cuba, there's a deep desire for change. People were shouting libertad, freedom, liberty. They were shouting abajo la dictadura, down with the regime, patria y vida, homeland and life, which is the song made by very famous Cuban musicians, which has become an anthem of resistance and change. People are tired of living without freedom, of seeing how Cubans abroad do so well wherever they go, and seeing how restricted and controlled life in Cuba is. And so I think there's a new generation that wants change. There's a people who want that liberation to come about, and they also feel supported by their families and their friends and their people abroad who haven't stopped demonstrating since this uprising began in Cuba.
You know what? Something that you said, I mean, look, that Cubans for a while have felt This tension growing, this unhappiness with the way things are. But I wanted to get a sense of why it's different now. And I'm wondering, is how much of it is because you don't have a Castro in power? If Castro was still in power, would this be happening?
Well, you still have a Castro in power. Raul Castro still has a lot of power in Cuba, and I think he oversees everything inevitably. I think Fidel Castro was the great totalitarian leader. He had a fine-tuned repressive apparatus all around him. He also had a discourse, a totalitarian discourse, that for a long time, the propaganda was very effective. But people have seen, they've lived, and they felt with their own lives, the lies of communism, the lies of totalitarianism, and they contrasted with their daily lives. And that discourse has faded away. We began to see the level and extent of active popular discontent with the so-called referendum on the new constitution, the regime installed. The regime had to recognize that there was such a great voter withdrawal from the elections. And remember, in Cuba, voting is very much enforced by the state. It's not really voting because there aren't any options. But people, the state media, the propaganda, the state-run social organizations, they try and get people out there to vote for the constitution or whatever it is. A great amount of people did not go vote. And we've had, 2 years ago, we also had that neighbors in the town of Regla, which is near Havana, they threw rocks at the motorcade of Díaz-Canel. So there's seething
so there's anger something different.
And the desire to be free.
Yeah, there's something different going on. Danny, I want to talk about a pro-government rally that they had on Saturday. But first, I just wanted to get a sense from you as well is what you're hearing from people here in South Florida about why they think this is different than anything else they've seen before.
Well, a big difference is that, like Orlando said, there have always been little bits of protest, small groups of dissidents that have always been present ever since the Cuban Revolution came to power. And the last big one, if you can call it that, was in 1994 in Havana. They call it the Maleconazo. That was a big thing, but it was only in Havana. So these things have been popping up here and there and in small cities and in big cities, but never at the same time. And what we saw last week was because of social media, because people in San Antonio de los Baños, which is just southwest of Havana, people started live streaming when there was a march in that town. And because Cubans are connected to the internet now, the government basically allowed cell phone connections with the internet about 2 years ago. So now a lot of people are connected and they started seeing that and then going out to the streets in their own towns. And we've never seen something like that happen before.
And it goes back to, what Orlando said, but what also we've been reporting is that in having that access to the internet now, connecting people, a lot of people, I wanted to ask about this because we've seen all these protests in Cuba, also here in South Florida, and in Washington, D.C., but there are also pro-government rallies, right, in Havana, and these are led by the government.
Right.
Okay. So you spoke with Adine Cervantes, who lives here in Hialeah, but she's got a cousin in Havana, and she had to go to one of these rallies. She was forced to go.
Right. So this is the way that totalitarian regimes work, right? They create leverage on the population, and they are able to manipulate that leverage to make people do things that they want to do. So if the government says we want to have a big showing of support for the government, well, the main employer on the island is the government. So the government can use that and hang that over your head and say, if you don't do what we want you to do, you don't come out to this march, tomorrow you might not have a job. And that's a big stick to carry.
And by the way, there's a quick cut I wanted to play. This is again from Adine Cervantes, who lives here in Hialeah. This is her. She's talking about her cousin in Havana going to this pro-government rally.
Bueno, tengo un familiar que por temor a perder su carrera, su trabajo, lo han obligado a salir.
And by the way, Danny, how many of these pro-government rallies are there? Are they trying to just keep up with how many protests there are? Do we know?
Well, not really. I mean, we know even since that Sunday that there have been smaller kind of protests popping up around. And sometimes it's only one person. There was a video that came out the other day of basically one person in the street with a poster saying Libertad, freedom. and they crack down on it. You know, the fact is, the internet has been such a tool for activism and just the mobilization of what people have access to, because they've for decades only had state media basically, and now that's broadening out. But after the protests on Sunday, there was a widespread shutdown of the internet in Cuba. There's still some, you know, it's slightly been rolled back, but there's still some apps and some means of communication that are still cut off. So we don't know what the full picture of what's happening on the island is.
And as we heard yesterday, there are people who are using VPN to try to get around the government's shutdown of the internet. We've been hearing from folks on social media, and by the way, you can find us on Twitter or Facebook at WLRN Sundial. This one we got from WLRN's Instagram. Instagram user Reiko Mengania commented, quote, "The main reason why the demonstration is different is because it's the only one at a national level. 1994, as Danny brought up, was in Havana. This is happening everywhere." Nora, I wanted to bring you in on this. You know, before we talk about the Biden administration's announcement yesterday, right now, I wanted your take. All the years you've spent reporting on Cuba, is this really different?
Hi, Luis. Great to talk to you again. Yes, it is. Definitely, I agree with Danny. He was pointing out that, you know, there have been in Orlando, there have been like previous protests, but, you know, this was island wide and this was, you know, spontaneous, and people were primarily chanting, you know, end with the dictatorship, freedom, right. Libertad. I mean, there was really a sense of, you know, this is it. And we want change, and we want to say it on the streets. I think that's the main change, is that people are taking back public space, which have been, you know, so far almost completely controlled by the government. And the fact that they are calling names, Díaz-Canel calling names, it's also, you know, like there's a big legitimacy crisis in the country. And I've talked to a lot of people that have participated on the demonstrations, and they all said something changed. We're living in a different country now, and we're not going to be silenced again.
And if I can just jump in from what Nora said, there has been, while this was spontaneous, there has been momentum building up to this. This did not come out of nowhere. Basically, after the internet arrived via cell phone to the island, there has been movements. Like, there was an animal rights movement a couple years ago, which the government actually did allow them in that narrow way to actually march and protest, and they actually got the law changed. That's a big moment for Cubans, and it was the talk of the town, if you will, that people say, oh wow, if we go into the streets demanding change, you know, it was a narrow thing. But it was a long fought for thing. And then since then, there has been other protests against censorship for a new law that censors artists. So this thing has been building momentum for some time.
Orlando, go ahead.
No, I also want to point out that that protest by young artists in front of the Ministry of Culture after the regime cracked down on the San Isidro hunger strikers was also a very big, important moment, because we had young intellectuals who were affiliated with regime-run operations who came out and demonstrated in front of the Ministry of Culture. One other thing, just on a historical note, in the 1960s, there were widespread farmer uprisings throughout Cuba against the regime. But since that time, I haven't seen anything like this.
And so what I'm hearing then, it sounds like it's the internet is giving that connectivity and maybe a little more courage to people. But Nora, I mean, is that, do you think that the Cuban government would ever allow, or you get the sense that they're going to allow the internet to come back, or they're going to reopen it? Because that seems to be an organizing factor for folks.
It is. You know, they delayed as far as they could, you know, the introduction of internet service in Cuba. That's the first thing. You know, it was years and years, and Cubans were not, you know, they were isolated, they were not connected. The problem for them is that they needed also to connect to, you know, international economy. And at some point, they needed to provide internet service. So the service have been coming back. They are still censoring, you know, communication platforms like, you know, WhatsApp, Signal, Telegram, Facebook. But they do need to provide the service because now they need it for their own, you know, economy. So they have a big problem, you know. I understand that they are censoring, for example, images of the protests. If you try to send someone a video via WhatsApp of the protest, that person is not gonna get it. So in a way, they're trying to fine tune like their own tools for censorship.
Again, we are talking about the ongoing anti-government protests in Cuba and what they mean for the island. As we've been hearing, this is very different. We haven't seen this since the revolution back in the late 1950s, early 60s. You can share your thoughts, your stories. You can share what you're hearing from home, maybe, if you're still in communication with folks. Just find us on Sundial at WLRN Sundial on Twitter or Facebook, or email us, sundial at WLRNnews.org. Again, talking with Nora Gámez-Torres of the Miami Herald, also Orlando Gutierrez-Boronat of the Cuban Democratic Directorate, and WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. Danny, you also were covering some local protests here in South Florida. They're still ongoing. There's still demonstrations and gatherings in different places. These were some recent chants, and I believe these were where?
This was at the Freedom Tower
on
Saturday.
On Freedom Tower on Saturday. This is what we heard. My understanding, at one point they were chanting, "If Biden can't, we want Trump." Right?
Right, that's what they were chanting. Si Biden no puede, queremos a Trump.
What are people asking of the U.S. government?
So this is what's going on politically. A lot of people are asking. You know, you can't leave it out of the conversation. Cuban Americans largely went for Donald Trump in this past election. There's a lot of, you know, there has been a split and movement in recent years in that direction towards the Republican Party, and now with Biden in office, there's calls for something that's not always exactly clear what they're calling for. So like one of the chants that they were just chanting was acción, just action. And then another one is intervention. They want the Biden administration to do something. And that chant that we just heard, if Biden won't, we want Trump. It speaks to where this is politically as a domestic issue. And politics, the Cuban-American relationship has for many years been a domestic political issue in the United States. Almost, I would argue, more than it's been a foreign policy issue, and we're still seeing that play out.
Orlando, what is this action that Cubans here in South Florida want to see?
Listen, first of all, I want to disagree with, there's an audio clip you put. I was in that rally since before it started until it ended, and that chant was a small part overall of what people were chanting. People were insisting on freedom. They were shouting down with the dictatorship. That was a moment, a very small moment during the event. I'm not saying Cuban Americans didn't vote for Trump. I'm saying that in the rally, that was an exception to what people were calling for. When we say intervention, we're very clear on what we're saying. We're up against a regime which has crushed uprisings throughout history in a very bloody manner. It's a regime that has directed repression and crushing popular movements in Nicaragua, in Venezuela, for God's sake, even in Syria. So it's a very bloody regime. It's a criminal regime. And we're afraid for the Cuban people. We're seeing the violence taking place, the hundreds of arrests, the violence in the streets. So what we're saying is that no option should be off the table when you're dealing with a regime such as this. Strategic intervention, both humanitarian and also military by the U.S. in Bosnia and Serbia and Libya was essential in protecting peaceful protests against the regime. And the other thing I also want to say, it's a moment of unity in the community. And I'm seeing Cubans from all parties, from all different walks of life, uniting in expressing support for the protests in Cuba and desiring that they're protected from the violence taking place and from the disappearances. So yeah. What I've seen is that overall, overwhelmingly, Cubans have put domestic politics behind, and we're all unified. And not all of us, most of us are unified in calling for freedom in Cuba and real change.
And I will agree with Orlando. I mean, that is most of what's going on. There is widespread unity in the Cuban-American community here.
And also I want to point out, I've been to several rallies. We've organized some of them. You know, I haven't seen a single partisan flag. I saw one at the Freedom Tower. There was only one. The rest were Cuban flags, American flags. Honestly, that's what I've seen.
I do want to mention, by the way, because, again, we're hearing from our listeners on social media. Miguel Ito in Miami commented again on WLRN's Instagram, quote, "It is about time, actually way overdue, for change to that brutal, repressive regime. The sad part is that as long as the armed forces are against the people, the change is very difficult unless there is a military intervention orchestrated by the UN," end quote. Nora, I wanted to come to you as we finish up this part of the conversation. Is, again, the Biden administration yesterday talking about, one, trying to get remittances back to Cuba, and also talking about the U.S. Embassy in Havana. Just real briefly, the remittances part, what's the situation right now with that, and what would Biden suggest?
Well, let me start by, you know, if I may, saying that, you know, the military intervention, I don't think it's going to happen. That's what I'm hearing from the administration. I mean, there's no whatsoever political will to do that. It's, you know, not a practical solution, they're saying. So the Biden administration is actually trying to focus on things they can do. And one of the things they're, you know, looking at is trying to find a way to send remittances to the island that do not go to the hands of, you know, the Cuban government and the military. That's going to be very complicated. I mean, the Trump administration sanctioned military entities that were handling remittances. And you can say that maybe the Biden administration might get the Cuban government to agree to, you know, handle, to put a, you know, a state-owned entity that is not controlled by the military is in charge of handling remittances. And actually, the Cuban government had already agreed to that. The problem is that even if you do that, all the money at the end of the day, it's going to go at the hands of the government because, you know, the state owns all the food stores, all the markets. So it's going to be like very hard to say we want to send remittances, but not, you know, let the government to take a cut.
Right.
Right now, the problem is, you know, there's almost no way to send money to your family in Cuba. I'm right. hearing of people paying, you know, like irrational fees for you know, sending some money, even using Bitcoin to send money. The fact is right now it's extremely difficult, and there's a lot of unfortunately vulnerable people in Cuba that need remittances to survive.
And again, I want to move over. What did he say? What did the Biden administration say about the U.S. Embassy in Havana? How do they want to use that?
The thing is they haven't disclosed many deals. The main obstacle for resuming consular services is this unexplained, you know, health events that, you know, officials also, you know, on background call them attacks that happened in Havana. And now we know in many other cities and that, you know, made many diplomats and CIA agents ill. And pretty much the government, the U.S. government doesn't know who caused this. I mean, there's suspicions that, you know, a foreign adversary did this. So the problem is, how do you staff the embassy while at the same time, you know, you take precautions so that doesn't happen again? So I don't know if the Biden administration would get the Cuban government to give some assurances. But in general, you know, the administration has not released a lot of details because I do think they haven't gotten to the nitty gritty of, you know, policy decisions yet.
And we will keep up on that story as well. I want to thank Nora Gámez-Torres, Miami Herald Latin America policy reporter. Also, we spoke with Orlando Gutierrez-Boronat of the Cuban Democratic Directorate. Nora, Orlando, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Luis.
And we're going to continue our conversation. Still to come, we're going to hear about the role of artists and Afro-Cuban writers in leading this protest movement. That's coming up next.
Sirena, porque con tu voz se van mis penas.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Patria y Vida has become the rallying cry for the Cubans in South Florida and on the island. The song is a collaboration with multiple Cuban groups, Gente de Zona, Orishas, and the artist Decemed Bueno. Patria y Vida, meaning homeland and life, is a play on the revolution slogan from more than 60 years ago, Patria o Muerte, meaning homeland or death. Cuban artists, musicians, writers, and academics have been on the forefront of the ongoing protest known as the San Isidro Movement, pushing the culture and language around resistance. Still with us right now, WLRN reporter Danny Rivero, but also joining us, Vanessa Garcia, a writer and playwright here in Miami. She's working directly to get the message of Cuban artists through her Instagram, the Abre Camino Collective. And Alejandro de la Fuente, director of the Afro-Latin American Research Institute at Harvard University, is joining us as well. And again, remember, you can always email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Alejandro, I want to start with you. The San Isidro movement in Cuba has a fascinating history with musicians, writers, academics, cultural figures. How did that protest outside of Cuba's Ministry of Culture last year launch the group into the national spotlight?
Well, the group in fact comes in the wake of other forms of Afro-Cuban, Afro-descendant mobilization that have been taking place in Cuba since at least the 1990s, and hip hop has been central to those forms of mobilization. So San Isidro is, in a way, an outcome, a development of previous efforts to highlight particularly the exclusion of people of African descent from this new form of sort of state capitalism that has developed in Cuba since the so-called special period in the 1990s.
And Alejandro, I mean, just give me a little bit of a take on, you know, that significance, especially of hip hop in this movement.
Well, hip hop, you know, it's not a coincidence that the very anthem of dissent and protest in Cuba now is a hip hop song with prominent hip hop musicians. This collaboration, you know, those who participating from Cuba, Michael Osorbo and El Funky are both self-identify as hip hop artists, as rap artists. Luis Manuel Otero Alcantara doesn't, but he's an artist on a different area. But if you want to recover the sounds of Cuban descent and the sounds of Cuban protest during the last 30 years, hip hop is the place to look. And the sort of play that Patria y Vida does with a slogan of official slogan of the revolution is something that hip hop artists have done before. You know, one good example is the famous song Tengo, I Have, of the Duo Hermanos de Causa from the mid-1990s, in which they played with the famous poem by Nicolás Guillén, Tengo.
Yeah. You know, Danny, because we were talking about this before, I just wanted your take on, and I didn't realize this, but, you know, the role hip-hop, and we're talking about hip-hop from the island, right?
Yeah.
That's been playing in this, in this messaging.
Right, yeah, it's, you know, hip-hop, just to start off, it was born in the United States in New York from people in marginalized communities that were largely left behind of progress happening in other places. And that has been the core of hip hop worldwide. And this the situation in Cuba is no different. You know, this is a voice for the people that have been disenfranchised, the people that don't have services and goods that they need. You know, hip hop in the States is taken a kind of a different direction. It's about money, et cetera. But in a lot of parts of the world, it's about your rights. It's about revolution. You know, the Arab Spring that started in Tunisia, that started, you know, it really picked up because of a hip hop song. They took down a regime. And, you know, some of the big hip hop artists now, we mentioned Gente de Zona, Los Orishas, and they did Patria y Vida. But another artist very worth mentioning, El Micha, has a very powerful anti-government song called Un Sueño, or A Dream. Bárbaro Vargas, El Urbano, has just came out with a very strong song. So it's just, you know, if the island is an island of discontent, which it is, this stuff is being cranked out, because the more discontent there is, the more people want to create and give voice to that frustration. And that's what we're seeing with hip-hop.
You know, Vanessa, you've been in contact with writers and artists on the ground in Cuba that are involved in this, the San Isidro movement. Give us a sense of the level of surveillance, though, and the threats that these individuals face on a daily basis. I mean, they don't have that room for freedom that we take for granted.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Right now we have Michael, who's been mentioned, and Manuel Otero Alcantara. They're both in prison. They're only able to speak when they can get their voice out into the world through whatever means possible. And it's not just them. Those are the things that we know. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of others that for putting those words into a rap song or making an image that serves against the government is completely surveilled both at home, on the streets. There's no sense of privacy. There are intrusions, there are home invasions, there are jailings. There is no human rights, definitely no artistic rights, but you can't have artistic rights without human rights and freedom of expression. So none of that exists.
And Vanessa, you said you know about hundreds of artists that have just disappeared, mm-hmm. right? Did I hear that right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we have the numbers are unclear as always, because obviously this is a regime which does not reveal numbers, but there are plenty of organizations that are releasing numbers. And these are just of networks of people that are known people to people. So Cuba Decide, for example, has released, I think the last number was upwards of 400 people who are speaking up against the regime. Many of those artists, many of those who stood in front of the Ministry of Cultural Affairs in November of last year. Mm-hmm. This is not just something that started yesterday, but they were there from the beginning. It started even before that, before November, with Dennis Solis, another rapper who they imprisoned, and his fellow artists were calling for him. They said, we're not going to take this anymore. You can't just take us away and disappear us when you don't want to hear our voice. We want our country back. And that has been something that has been in the lyrics of songs forever. I mean, David Diomni has a song called Pásalo, which is essentially pass the light, pass the country, back to us. El bloqueo aquí eres tú, que no quieres dar la luz. Here, the blockade is you that doesn't want to give us light.
There's so much interesting to this. Alejandro, I wanted to come back to one point here, though. I don't want to miss this opportunity. You know, beyond the pressures that Afro-Cuban artists face from the government, Cuba has a deep history of racism and anti-blackness. Help me understand some of that history and the ways that these artists had to overcome.
Well, you know, Cuba is a country, it's a nation built on the ashes of slavery. Slavery lasted longer in Cuba than anywhere else in the New World. And Cuba was the second to last to abolish slavery in 1886. The last one was Brazil 2 years later. So anti-black racism is part of the very fabric of the Cuban nation. White supremacy is part of the very fabric of the Cuban nation. And therefore struggles over what Cuba is as a nation have always been struggles over blackness and whiteness and how to imagine that nation. What has happened in the last 30 years, and this connects directly with the Movimiento San Isidro and with this new generation of activists and artists, is the fact that this new state capitalism has basically recreated or created new forms of social and economic organization that result in the exclusion of people of African descent. And the first area to think about that is, you were talking about remittances before in the program.
Yeah.
Well, Afro-Cubans, the proportion of remittances that flow to Afro-Cubans is considerably lower than the proportion of remittances that flow to white
that's
Cubans,
not because
of a racist design, not because of a racist intent by the Cuban American community, but because of the composition of the Cuban American community.
That's a very interesting point. It's something I hadn't thought about. Real briefly, I just wanted to chime in and remind people, again, talking about looking through, the eyes of and the minds of artists and musicians in these ongoing demonstrations in Cuba. Again, talking with author Vanessa Garcia, also Alejandro de la Fuente, director of the Afro-Latin American Research Institute at Harvard University, and WLRN's Danny Rivero. And Alejandro, I apologize not to cut in, but only because of time. Something interesting about this, when we talk about Afro-Cubans, And of course, so much has happened here in the United States these last few years with the Black Lives Matter movement. But this hit the news big recently. There was a tension between Black Lives Matter in the U.S. and the Cuban political protest. This is from America Valdez, an Afro-Cuban activist based in the U.S.
Black and brown people are disproportionately affected by the regime. If you look at the Cuban dissidents and the activists that have been imprisoned for trying to speak out against the government this year, a lot of them are black and brown. The most important dissident in Cuba right now is black because they are disproportionately affected.
Danny, help me understand, you know, this tension between the BLM activists and this Cuban protest movement, and what was the controversy?
I mean, basically, it comes down to blind political ideology, which is what the Black Lives Matter organization has displayed. You know, I just will point out there's an organization called Black Lives Matter, and there's a more or less grassroots movement of Black Lives Matter that has come beside it. But there is an organization. The organization released this statement about the protests, basically putting all the blame on the U.S. They didn't even mention any state repression. They didn't mention any beatings, you know, one death that we know of, disappearances. They made no mention of any of the above, basically just in support of this socialist ideology that they're supporting. Now, on the island, the way that this was received, as Alejandro and America Valdez just said, is, what are you guys talking about? Like, black resistance to oppression is Cuban history, you know, going back to the two independence wars, huge representation from Afro-Cubans. Every large social movement that has ever happened on the island has been with Afro-Cubans leading it. And this is included in that. So the way that has been interpreted on the island is just a slap in the face to a lot of Afro-Cubans and just Cubans in general that are all, you know, they want to change their system.
I know that could be a conversation of itself we can carry on. But Vanessa, I wanted to finish up with you. Very interesting. You wrote for the Boston Globe this quote: "I was born in the United States of America on Cuba's largest moon, Miami. When Cuba fights, we fight. When Cuba hurts, we hurt." You feel a strong connection to Cuba, as do many other Cuban Americans born in the U.S. How does that connection influence, you know, art from the diaspora and the messaging from diaspora?
I mean, I feel that connection is massive, and part of it, I think there's a lot that instigated that connection. Obviously, our roots and what's inside of us, our history, our parents, all of that. But having known this story and having seen it be veiled to the world for so long, and then seeing it sort of become unmasked is a huge thing. But the other thing I wanted to say is that, you know, the videos that have been coming out of Cuba for the last several months, for the over a year now, I mean more than that, from people like Luis Manuel Otero Alcántara, you know, at the end of every video that he gives, he says "estamos conectados," and he's telling the people we're connected. He's telling the people inside the island, the people of his movement, of the San Isidro movement, the Cuban people, we're all connected. And we heard that, and we feel it across the Florida Straits, and we feel that message. We're very much connected. And when they cannot get their message out, or they're having trouble getting their message out, I do find it to be part of my responsibility when messages come to me through some crack in a WhatsApp that I need to amplify that out into the world and give it to the rest of the not only community but the greater international community. So I think it's just a moment of unity and connection.
I want to thank author Vanessa Garcia and also Alejandro de la Fuente, director of the Afro-Latin American Research Institute at Harvard University. I really appreciate the time. I want to spend more time with you, but running short on it. So thank you so much for the insight. And we're going to come back. We're going to take a quick break. When we get back, we're going to talk about how people are getting aid back to Cuba.
Desde que tengo uso de razón, lo que veo es problema y separación. Estoy mirando un pueblo en desesperación, y si no lo digo se me explota el corazón. Hasta los psicólogos caen en depresión. ¿Cómo decir que es buena si es mala la situación? Oye, coge la chancleta, mata el ratón. Yo lo que sé que es tiempo de encontrar la solución. A mí nadie me mandó, yo solo lo estoy haciendo.
Dándole... Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Again, talking about these historic protests in Cuba, how they're stirring political pressures here in the U.S. and around the world. And of course, those protests and the anxiety over the future of the country has made its way to South Florida, home to a very large Cuban diaspora. Many of the of them are organizing now here in South Florida to help those back on the island, trying to get supplies, trying to get the internet back to Cuba. Joining me now is Diane, who's been leading donation efforts to get Cubans on the island internet and phone access. We're not using her last name to protect her and her family's safety and livelihood. Also joining us is Gennady Rodriguez. He's an editor for the local political blog and podcast, 23 y Flagler. Again, and still joining us here in the studio is WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. Gennady, I wanted to ask you, in these last couple of weeks, how have you used your blog and your podcast, 23 y Flagler, to connect with people, but also not here just in South Florida, maybe back in Cuba?
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Well, I do leave what broadcasting. This is more like webcast. I'm doing it almost every day. And when the protest started on the last July 11th, I started to go live almost every day. The way I'm doing is I'm trying to share all the videos that are coming from Havana. I'm bringing people who are in Cuba, telling their stories of what happened, and bringing a lot of people from the Cuban American community from very different points of view, so they can talk to each other and they can process what just happened. Because I have been hearing, listening to the other speakers here, and indeed there was a big change in Cuba on July 11th. It showed that right now that monolithic support for the Cuban government is not there anymore. They will have to recognize at some point that there is a plurality within the island. And for the first time in six decades, we have seen a nationwide protest. So definitely, at least all the imagination of every Cuban around the world is going to be ignited because of these events.
Yeah. Diane, you've been collecting donations to help Cubans on the island, communicate using their phones. How did you get started doing this?
Hi. I started about 5 days ago, so the second day of protest. I was reloading my family members' phones to Cuba, and they let me know that they ran out of data extra fast because they were recording and trying to connect to others on the island about what's happening. So this gave me the idea that, probably a lot of other Cubans were running out of data, and I wanted to connect them, and I felt like it's the only thing I could do. So I started doing it.
How do you do that? How do you help them get that data?
Yeah, so we use a company called Cuba Messenger. They have an app. It's very user-friendly. You sign up with your phone number, an email, and a credit card. And after that, you simply add contacts to your profile and you can buy them data. So for $22.99, we buy them 500 Cuban pesos worth of talking minutes and 2 gigabytes of data. This usually can last them a couple weeks depending on how much they use it. But because most Cubans are out in the streets and they are recording the protest, it runs out rather quickly.
And what about, wondering if there's any fear of being tracked by the government?
There wasn't fear at first. I honestly didn't think this was going to grow to the magnitude that it has. I thought I would be able to help 10 or 20 people. And we've now done over 1,000 phones in 6 days. So there is fear of the government tracking us, but the fear doesn't outweigh how important what we're doing is, and so we just have to keep going.
Yeah, and you know what? Is it challenging navigating the government, trying to get around them to get that to get the data to Cubans, to get anything to Cubans?
Yes. So we have to be smart with the companies that we use, because in the end, we do have to go through Edexa, which is the communications company in Cuba, but we pay an American company first. So if they notice that you're doing too many at once or using the same credit card too much, they will flag you and eventually shut down your profile. So we're now on our fourth company, and so far so good with this one, but we are willing to change as many times as possible to keep going.
Danny, what are some of the other challenges for people to get anything from the U.S. to Cuba right now? Are they even able to?
You know, it's a heavy question because there are limitations with the U.S. embargo with sending some things. There's a lot of exceptions to that, but it still remains very difficult to do certain transactions. You know, like I have a Venmo account. If I Venmo a friend that says Cuban sandwich, they red flag that for sanctions. So do that to a whole island. It's difficult to do transactions in any form, even if things are technically legal. You know, there has been a movement, small movement, but it's a lot of chatter around it about people wanting to get together in boats here and maybe go to Cuba themselves, take humanitarian aids. Yeah. I was there at the marina the other day. Some people were putting guns in and saying, we're going to go invade the island. Not a lot of, you know, that's not happening. And I'll just mention, because we were talking about military intervention or some kind of violent intervention there, from what I've heard, read, seen on the island, there does not seem to be any support for that.
You know, we're hearing from our listeners in many different ways. This is Chuck Epstein writes via email, quote, Cuba poses no military or ideological threat to the U.S., so why do Miami Cubans keep agitating against Cuba when the real poverty in Cuba is enabled by the U.S. embargo? Let's not let some agitated Miami Cubans dictate U.S. policy, end quote. Gennady, there's been a lot of conversation about this embargo and how it's affecting Cuba. What's the response here? What's your response to that?
Well, I've been an activist against the current U.S. policy towards Cuba, because I do believe that it impoverishes the people and actually it makes for them more difficult to achieve any kind of democratic standards. However, after what happened on Sunday, we do need to ask to keep accountable the Cuban government because of what happens. Because if we say that all the responsibility of what happens in Cuba is because of the embargo, then Washington is governing in Cuba, and the Cubans are not governing themselves. So there is responsibility within the Cuban state and for the Cuban government, because they have been able to do so many things, so many reforms. For example, the protests are in part because of an unfinished economical reform that was advertised in the times of Raul Castro, the updating of the economical system that was never taken to the, you know, to the whole extent. And people is really complaining because they're not seeing any results. So, yes, the embargo is there. The embargo is certainly causing a lot of economic pain to the Cuban people. But the main responsible of not taking the appropriate measures, of not doing the right thing, not following the recommendation of their own scientists, the economists, the sociology people. So the only responsible for that are the Cuban government. And I do think it will help if we change the policy towards Cuba. But we cannot say that, for example, the limits to the freedom of expression is because of the embargo. No, yeah. That's something that they do themselves.
And Danny, what are you hearing from folks here about the embargo? Because again, we go back to what we heard before. It's like there has to be some action taken. What do they say about the embargo?
Well, the support for the embargo is pretty steadfast, especially here in South Florida. To Gennady's point, I mean, there is a disconnect, I think I can say pretty bluntly, between people here in the exile and people on the island. The embargo, whatever you call it, they call it the bloqueo, is incredibly unpopular on the island itself. It makes economic conditions harder. It makes living harder. But it's used as a tool by the U.S. government to do just that, to hopefully make things so bad that people go out into the streets. Obviously, the freedom of speech repression is not because of the embargo, but the embargo is one of those factors that got people to the streets.
Diane, I'm going to finish with you. I just wanted to know if you've heard, from anyone back in Cuba, as to, how this is affecting them and what they're hoping for next.
I have had the chance to connect to many people while recharging their data. Some activists, lots of families. Many people are thankful. Many people share very sad stories, and they tell me they're able to talk to their grandmother that has COVID and, in a hospital bed, but sitting outside the room because there's no space for her, things like that. And, they just want freedom. That's what they're screaming in the streets. They're not screaming in the embargo. They're screaming freedom. And in the end, The U.S. can't give them freedom. Cuba gives them freedom. It's their country that they're fighting for, that they want. So that's the main message that I hear. They just want to live free, to use their voice, to be able to protest.
I want to thank my guests. We have come to the end of this program, an amazing conversation, but we have to stop here. I want to thank Diane, who's been leading donation efforts to get Cubans on the island internet access. Also, I want to thank Gennady Rodriguez, editor of the local political blog and podcast, 23 y Flagler, and also WLRN reporter Danny Rivero. Thank you all so much for sharing with us today. And you know what? You can keep the conversation going because we want to hear from you, your thoughts on what the U.S.'s approach should be, what you're hearing back from family and friends back in Cuba, and where we go from here. Where does this story continue? We keep hearing that these protests, that everything is, this is different. This is different than anything we've seen since the revolution. But where does it go from here? What happens next? Find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial or email us sundial@WLRNnews.org. We're going to keep this conversation going into the future. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.
WLRN Public Media.